Bristol Banter, your geeky conversational podcast. We are your hosts,
Jenny
and Rory Bristol.
Welcome to our premiere episode.
Today's theme is about firsts, because this is our first episode.
Despite the theme, we're going to start with a short segment that hopefully will be in every episode called Did You Know? It has nothing to do with firsts, but it does have to do with old stuff.
And it is our first Did You Know, after all.
Right, so the theme is inherent there. Did you know that Vikings didn't actually wear horned helmets?
Yes. So I've always found it really interesting. It was actually for an opera. One of the costumers put horns on someone's helmet in the opera. And that's where this comes from. I always thought that was really neat.
Well, according to the History Channel, the only helmet that they have found from the era did not have horns on it. But they're also saying that before the Vikings, the Norse and Germanic priests did wear helmets that had horns on them, but only for ceremonial purposes.
Oh, well, that's actually pretty neat.
I wonder what they look like.
Maybe a bit like the ones from the operas.
Hard to say, because there are lots of different kinds of horns.
Yeah.
Different shapes.
I wonder if they're actually, you know, some sort of bovine creature with that kind of horn there. You know, at the time. It just seems like it'd be a lot more in the line with reindeer or something like that.
I'm thinking antlers.
Yeah, rather than horns.
Horns they reserve for drinking.
Right. But also tusks. You know, there are all kinds of interesting things, but most of them I don't imagine being very effective as helmets. But of course, none of it's meant to be. It's just ceremonial. Okay, now on to our topics of discussion.
World's firsts.
Who was the first British queen to rule for more than 60 years?
Queen Victoria.
Yes, that's right. Now, why is that such a big deal?
Because she ruled longer than anyone?
Yes, but also because the life expectancy of an individual up until 1901, I think is when she died.
She died in 1901.
Up to then was much shorter than 75. I think she was about 75 because she became the queen when she was a teenager.
And she had a lot of kids. And she didn't die in childbirth or have her health negatively affected, I guess.
Right.
But also, she was queen during a great time of colonization and ruling different parts of the world, so she was quite the powerful woman.
Yeah, she was also the Empress of India. That was one of her titles.
Part of colonization, yes.
It was pretty freaking neat. Could you imagine being the monarch of Britain and the monarch of this entire empire, which they had at the time?
Because they forced themselves on other cultures. But
we're Americans. We got no room to talk.
Next question.
Do you know who the first president of Russia was? Boris Yeltsin, Vladimir Putin, Dmitry Medvedev, and Vladimir II.
Oh, it was Boris Yeltsin.
It was Boris Yeltsin, that's right. I thought it was Dmitry Medvedev. So here's one that I think you will probably know. What was the first planet to be discovered using a telescope? Not the naked eye, but a telescope.
Well, let's see. You can see most of the planets. Uranus.
That's right. Uranus was the first one discovered with a telescope. It was discovered by William Herschel, in 1781. Up until Herschel identified it as a planet, people thought it was just a star, because you could occasionally see it, but it didn't move in a significant way, you know, on a yearly basis, the way other planets that are closer to us did. And so they just thought it was a star, and they thought that the people who had previously mapped it were just doing it wrong each time they mapped that part of the sky. But yeah. It takes 84 years. So, you know, if you imagine they map it only once a century, it could be back where it was the last time they mapped it.
Right.
You know, or close enough that they're like, oh, well, that person just obviously put this dot in the wrong place. Because you can see it with the naked eye. They just couldn't identify it as a planet. Which is just really kind of bizarre. It's like, oh, we can see this planet, but we don't know it's a planet for a couple of centuries after we've just, you know, identified the other planets.
I'm sure it was more than a couple. Well, after the other planets.
Yeah.
But some of the planets have been known for many centuries. Okay, next.
Do you know what the title was for the first video to ever be uploaded to YouTube?
Oh, I read about this recently. It was some silly one that wasn't anything terribly interesting.
Right.
But I don't know the title of it.
It was called Me at the Zoo.
That's right.
Okay, so how long was it?
10 seconds.
19 seconds. I think the maximum time when this was released was 25 seconds was maximum length of a video you could put on YouTube.
Well, my first digital camera only recorded 10-second videos.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was making videos of my baby daughter, it had to be 10 seconds at a time.
It has enjoyed over 18 million hits. Of course, it's been 9 years.
And it's good to be the first.
It's good to be the first. But this 19-second video of nothing of consequence has had 18 million views.
It's of consequence because it was the first and everybody wants to look.
Right. But the video itself, you know, the content is not of consequence. It's just, you know, there. Okay. Made from bone. The first musical instrument ever invented was what? The tabla? The flute? Pan pipes or an elephant skin drum?
Oh, I'd say the elephant skin drum.
It was actually a flute.
That I should have gotten my first gut because I was thinking it's got to be some sort of flute-like thing. But I thought that would be a lot harder to make than the drum. And when you would tan hides and things like that, you'd stretch them to dry and then you beat on them.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, hey, maybe they put that together and decided that's a drum.
Yeah, actually, it's probably something very similar. The flutes that we've found are like 67,000 years old. And they're made from bird bones, mostly, because they're already hollow.
Those are small.
Yeah, they're small. But you remember there were bigger birds back then.
True, and they just had to poke the holes in them.
Right. I just think that's really neat because the bones were already hollow. So they already had the sharp edge that you needed to make a whistle, make it sound. And then you only need to put in a couple of holes to change the pitch. So I've just always thought that was really cool. It's the simplest instrument. Today we have a very complicated version of the flute, but the flute itself has always been one of the simplest instruments on the planet.
Kind of like a recorder.
Right. Here's one for you. What was the first programmable computer? More specifically, the first electromechanical binary programmable computer. Was it the Z1? The Atanasoff Berry computer, the Colossus, or the EDSAC?
I should have been paying more attention at the Computer History Museum. I'll go Colossus.
It was the Z1.
Okay.
It was the first electrobinary programmable computer. So I think that's pretty neat that most people have never even heard of it, but I think it's really neat because it was Conrad Zuse, Z-U-S-E, not Zeus as in the god. And he invented it in Germany. Do you have any concept of what year that would have been?
Well, if it's the electro something, it had to have been in the last 150 years, of course. 1935.
Pretty good. 1936.
Seriously?
Yes. It had a 64-word memory, and each word took 22 bits and a clock speed of 1 hertz, 1 HZ, which is just crazy. And the output was punch tape. So it could do calculations, but it did it on punch tape instead of a display.
Well, even in the early 70s, my mom was programming in Fortran on punch cards. So
yeah.
The punch thing stayed around for decades.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, there are fewer decades between that and my mom programming in the 70s and the 70s and now. Oh, I feel really old now.
The world is aging, slowly but surely. What is the first and oldest bank in the world? I'll give you some choices. Was it the Berenberg Bank, which I believe is in Russia, the Monte dei Paschi di Siena, which I think is in Italy, the Bank of New York, or the Bank of Scotland?
I'm going to go the Bank of Scotland. Let's be different.
It was actually the Monte dei Paschi di Siena. It was established on the 27th of February, 1472, by the General Council of the Republic for the purpose of granting loans to the poor or needy people. It was a fully secular institution authorized from the beginning to charge an interest rate of about 7%. So the first interest rate, 7%.
Well, but your first ability to borrow money.
Yeah, so the risk threshold there was pretty low. I mean, it was pretty high for the bankers,
mm-hmm,
and pretty low for the lenders.
Well, 7% is a lot if you borrow a lot of money.
Right.
And if you're poor and needy, you're going to have a hard time paying it back.
Right.
If you don't have the money in the first place, now you have to pay back more.
Yeah. So that's probably why there's such a high interest rate. So the people who could pay back made up for the people who didn't. What was the first social networking website based on the web contacts model? Like,
what's web contacts model?
Like being able to connect you and another person so that you have contact to them through this website.
And so it's a website, not just some sort of...
Not a database or a BBS. Okay. Like an actual website. MySpace, Facebook, Friendster, and Six Degrees.
Oh, I remember Six Degrees. I'd say it was either Six Degrees or Friendster, because I remember.
Six Degrees.
Yeah.
And I think it's just really neat. It was introduced in 1997. It was popular until 2001. Andrew Wainwright created it, and the current owner is Marco View. At its peak, Six Degrees had about 100 employees, and the site had a maximum of about 35 million fully registered members. 35 million registered individuals on a social media website created in 1997. That's just damned impressive.
Well, you know, they had to start somewhere.
Yeah, but can you imagine setting up the first website that had that kind of participation?
Well, and you have to be a forward thinker to have come up with the idea for that to be a thing in the future.
Right. It's still 35 million registered. It's just kind of overwhelming, that number for that time period.
Do you remember one called Orkut? O-R-K-U-T?
Yes.
I think Yahoo might have been the ones behind that. I registered for that and then did nothing with it.
Yeah. It's a little bit like Sue, or what was that other one? Ello. E-L-L-O. Ello. Nobody ever used Ello. So many of us signed up for it, and then nobody used it.
Well, Facebook has market saturations, and so did Twitter, and Google Plus is doing okay. But
that's a good point. Is that Twitter and Facebook have like that critical mass where until something's really rung the website or something just much more stellar comes out, they have their audience forever because everybody's already networked in a variety of ways, including their high school, their college, their jobs.
Part of it also is that companies will put out a really cool tool and say, hey, this is neat. Look what you can do with this. People will take it and run with it and do completely different things than were originally anticipated. And then the design of the resource or the website or whatever it is will help go in the direction that the people are actually using it, not just how it was designed in the first place.
Well, that's what Facebook did when I first signed up for it. I had to actually use my brother's college email address to sign up for it. Because, you know, he just created a second one. And so he just gave me that, and off I went. I just created my first Facebook thing. But you had to have an EDU email address to sign up.
Right, and thus, I was not on Facebook until long after a lot of other people were, because I was way out of college by that point.
Yeah.
And I didn't have an EDU address, and it wasn't used back then the way it was used now.
Right.
And there wasn't a feed and things like that.
Well, when I was in college, you know, this was already a thing. And it was like the fastest way to share notes about a class or to remind people to, you know, remind your friends to bring something to class or to study without having to exchange phone numbers or email addresses directly with that individual.
Or anything personal.
Freaking lifesaver. Because I'm not going to give my cell phone number, especially back then when you had to pay for every minute. No, I'm not giving that number out to everybody. It costs like a quarter to text somebody, and people would just text me like it was nothing.
I'm laughing because when I was in the college, there was no internet. People didn't have cell phones, unless it was like a car phone, you know, with your little antenna off the back of your car. We had email addresses, but it was all... there was such a thing as the internet, but it was all text-based. Mm-hmm. There was Gopher and Archie and things like that.
Yeah.
And there wasn't quite the way you used email just for regular correspondence, like you would write a letter. You didn't use it to do group things with your fellow students or anything like that. So I didn't have the internet college experience.
Still, total lifesaver.
Next question.
Which among the following is the first organ that develops in an embryo? Kidney, pancreas, brain, or heart?
The heart.
It's the heart, yes. I thought it was going to be something stupid like the pancreas.
Well, the heart has to develop to pump blood to parts of the body so that the other ones can form.
Yeah.
You know, blood is the...
But even blood. To even until well after you've formed your heart and it's functioning, the mother's heart delivers most of the blood to the whole embryo.
Oh, certainly. You know, they're attached by the umbilical cord until they're born. But you've got to start somewhere, and mm-hmm. that's kind of the fundamental. You know, the heart is your quote-unquote lifeblood. So it's much more important than even having a brain at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are other organs that form first, but the heart is among the first. One of the more interesting ones to me is that babies develop their nipples and fingernails and toenails and eyelashes before they develop their sex organs. Like, they've got all of these, you know, their whole body is complete, and then at the very end the process says, here, have sexual organs.
Well, every baby starts out as a girl. I mean, like,
vaguely female. Yeah,
yeah. The boy sex organs don't form until later, so they look like a girl in utero until mm-hmm. later when they differentiate. I mean, they're differentiated to begin with because of the DNA and all that, but
before the expression.
Right. Before their DNA will express itself.
That's why it's so easy to have your baby misidentified as a girl, and then, surprise, you have a boy.
Right. Not the other way around.
It never happens the other way around. You identify as a boy, that's a boy. You know? Unless you just have somebody who is got the worst image, or, you know, they're not well practiced at identifying the sex of the baby.
Sometimes the baby will not cooperate and will not put themselves in a position to be inspected.
Yeah. Or they'll have, like, their foot turned round wrong, and then they'll think it's something else, and they're like, well, this is inconclusive because we can't actually tell what's going on there. I think that's crazy neat.
Okay, how old is the world's first surviving photograph made by a camera? What year do you think that happened?
It's one that's still alive today. They've preserved it through today.
Yes.
1875.
It's either 1826 or 1827. It's not on photographic paper. It was probably 1827. A man named Joseph Nicephore Niepce, some French name, took a picture from an upstairs window at his estate in the Burgundy region of France. You can just make out the view from his window in the photograph. He coined the term heliography, which is a form of lithography.
Mm-hmm.
He made the image on a pewter plate through a whole lot of chemistry going on that I don't understand. But the idea of being able to preserve something long-term on a substance and then be able to show it to somebody else. Can you imagine the first experience somebody would have to see a photo of a place you've never been or a person?
And it's not just a painting.
Right. That I would have just been blown away at that time.
I can imagine I would be too.
Okay, when do you think the first human was killed by a robot or died by the actions of a robot?
I would say probably 1965.
It was 1979.
Oh, wow.
January 25th, a man named Robert Williams was the first human killed by a robot.
Did he just walk into it?
I have my opinions on this, which I'll get to in a second. He was working at the Ford Motor Company in Flat Rock, Michigan, and a robot arm was retrieving parts from a bin, and then the robot arm started moving too slowly. I guess he wasn't patient enough. Maybe he was, you know, under restrictions to have a certain amount of quota done, or who knows. But so rather than reporting it or trying to get it fixed or whatever, he just jumped in the bin himself to retrieve the part, and he got hit in the head and was killed instantly.
Wow.
That's got to be not a good way to go, but he was the first one killed by a robot. His family was actually awarded $10 million in damages because of the lack of safety systems in place. Wow. And I'm thinking, sucks to be him, but that wasn't real bright to jump in the bin.
Yeah.
Knowing,
like, safety systems be damned. If you're going to climb in the bin, you're going to climb into the bin. I'm sorry. It just feels a little bit like Darwin Awards.
I'm in agreement with you there. He was only 25, so maybe he hadn't had kids yet. Anyway, but jump in the bin, it could just start working normally at any time. The world's first ATM, automatic teller machine.
Ooh, let's see. Probably before the New York Stock Exchange crashed. I have to wager 1915.
For an automatic teller machine?
Yeah.
Really?
I don't know what that really means.
Okay, it was 1967.
Oh, really? I totally would have pegged it as being earlier than that.
The first one was installed in London in 1967. It even used pins. personal identification numbers. But since magnetic stripes on ATM cards hadn't been invented yet, the machine depended on the checks that were being used to make withdrawal to be impregnated with the radioactive isotope carbon-14.
Oh my gosh. So the carbon-14 was what told it what to do? The yes. numbers written in carbon-14?
Or I don't know how... I don't know, the numbers are written in carbon-14, but I'm sure some sort of code was put in there. So they had to be special checks. It wasn't just any old check.
Oh my gosh.
But my first memory of an ATM was in the early 80s. This is before I had my first bank account. But by the time I had my first account, when I was about 12 or so that would have been the mid-80s, ATMs were everywhere. So I never really had to deal with a teller to get out any cash. I could just go to the ATM and get cash out. But before that, I have memories of my mom doing banking when I was younger, like in the 70s. And we do the drive up once, not drive through, but drive up. And you'd go, and she'd talk to a lady through a window and use those pneumatic tubes to put forms and cash back and forth. And we still got lollipops, and that's why we liked going. But I think it was a lifesaver for parents everywhere to be able to keep their kids in the car and banking. So that was a good invention whenever that was invented. But now we even make deposits in the ATM. And between online banking and ATMs, I hardly have to deal with tellers at all, which is great when you're an introvert.
Yeah, but not great when you have specific questions.
Well, then you can deal with people then.
Yeah.
World's first full-page advertisement in a national newspaper. I know that's specific.
Are you asking for the company or for the year?
You can give me any of it.
In a national newspaper, that you said? Okay.
Full-page advertisement.
I want to say it would have been in the 50s, and I bet it was probably something like a cola company.
No, but good guess. I like your reasoning. It was January 1st, 1829.
Whoa.
When the Times in London published a full-page advertisement for the book called Portraits and Memories of the Most Illustrious Personages in British History by Edmund Lodge. So you need a full-page ad just to have the whole title. I'm sure it costs quite a bit to have a full-page advertisement back then.
Oh, yeah. Because
the random person out there probably couldn't afford more than just a few lines.
Right.
But this was 1829, so this was before Queen Victoria was queen. No Winston Churchill, no Queen Elizabeth II. Of course, a whole lot of history happened before 1829, especially for Britain, but I'm wondering what they included, who they deemed to be the most important at that point. I want to know what they said about King George, who was king during the American Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
That would have been really interesting because he was thought of as being mad. I think he just had some undiagnosed mental illnesses. But imagine if he lived today, what kind of care he might have been able to get. But back then, he was thought of as kind of crazy.
Mad King George. Mm. That's neat.
Have you ever seen the movie The Madness of King George?
No.
You might actually enjoy
it. Is it about that King George?
Mm-hmm. It's very good. World's first person to run a mile in less than 4 minutes. This is something that always learned about because it just shows up in every Olympics. They talk about it as a historical event.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever actually watched enough of the Olympics for that kind of thing to come to my head, but I was a bit of a sports fan, and I was really interested in track for a while, so I did a lot of reading. I can't remember the guy's name. He was still alive when I was in high school, and he was quite old. He might even still be alive. It's the kind of thing that you might hear an obituary for, but let's see. It would have been probably like 75 years ago now. So that'd be probably the 1940s, probably. And it was a male track runner.
Do you know what country he's from?
I want to say one of the Nordic countries, Sweden or Norway or Scandinavia in general.
You are relatively close.
Belgium. No.
He was an Englishman.
Oh, okay.
His name was Roger Bannister. And he did it in 1954.
Hey!
Right.
That was 60 years ago, 61 years ago, right? Yeah.
I guess so, because it's 2015.
So I was off by a decade.
He didn't make this record during the Olympics, and in fact, he ran in the 1952 Olympics in Helsinki, and everybody thought he was going to do really well. He came in fourth. I mean, nowhere but the Olympics, you come in fourth and you're thought of as a failure, but the newspapers were saying he was a failure. And then 2 years later, he becomes the first person to break the four-minute mile.
Holy tamales.
And it was really, really windy that day, too, so he knew he had to run even faster to make up the time for the wind, you know, pulling him back.
Yeah.
But I read an account of the play-by-play of it, and the first little while, he actually ran behind somebody else and drafted him. So it was much, much easier for him to start off on a good rate. But it was interesting because he was a runner, but he ended up being a neurosurgeon or neuroscientist.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, a neurologist. And he led a full life, and the running of the first, you know, sub-4-minute mile was only a one note in his life. He got married, and he ended up getting Parkinson's disease.
Oh.
I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he was still alive recently, and he may still be alive now.
Okay, moving on to...
World's first road maps.
Oh, road maps.
When do you think... Who do you think made the first road maps?
Well, let's see. Roads were a classically Roman thing. They were like the road people. So, oh, serious. All roads lead to Rome because Rome built them all.
They had to take over the world after all.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's how they got their empire. I would say the first maps were built... I mean, the first maps were drawn by, I'd have to say, Greco-Romans in about 2 BC.
I don't have a year, I have to admit.
Oh.
It was Emperor Augustus Caesar. He put his son-in-law in charge of a giant mapping project that took surveyors almost 20 years to complete. It covered thousands of miles from the Middle East to Britain. When people got a look at the map, they were like, oh wow, this is awesome. We're going to use it for everything. And so they made more maps and more maps and more maps. It's possible, I suppose, that there were maps before this time, but the Romans made those early maps out of stone, carved them in stone, so of course they're going to last a lot longer than anything that may be on papyrus or something like that.
It was 20 BC. You put a team of surveyors to work mapping the empire's 50,000 miles of roads. It took them 20 years to map them.
Well, that's actually not too bad for that many miles.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I'm not mortified by that. I'm, like, super impressed. 20 years to map 50,000 miles. You don't have cars. You don't have satellite imaging. You barely
GPS.
Have... You don't even have cartographers at the time.
No, they had surveyors.
They had surveyors, but not...
Well, cartographers are people who make maps for a living, and they were just inventing maps, I guess.
Right. So so you didn't even have cartographers who that's what they studied for years. You know, you had people who were just... They were surveyors. They understood how the land worked and how measurements worked, obviously, in distances. But to map them out, they had to measure the distances between any two roads at a given point.
I think they probably used the lessons that they learned to design cities on a larger scale to design maps. World's first timekeeping device.
First timekeeping device. Let's see.
What was it called and when was it invented?
I would say it's probably as far back as 3,000 if it's not, like, a mechanical device.
3,000 what? Years
ago? Sorry, 3,000 years ago.
So, like, 1,000 BC?
Right. But if it's something like an hourglass or a sea clock, you're talking much more recent than that, probably.
Okay, who invented the first timekeeping device?
Well, if it's a specific who, then we're probably talking about Galileo.
He lived in, like, the 1500s.
Okay, then.
Do you want me to just tell you?
Yes, just tell me.
It was about 3500 BC in Mesopotamia.
Okay.
It was called a time stick.
Okay. A time stick.
A time stick. It predated sundials and hourglasses and things. It was just a long stick you put in the dirt, and it cast a shadow on the ground, which moved when the sun moved. Later versions of the time stick got really fancy, and they used time scales for months and seasons and things. Then around 2500 to 2000 BC, the Egyptians started using obelisks for this purpose.
Mm.
Then sundials were downright modern, first being used in 300 BC. So later the hourglass came along. People could use it to tally time, but it wasn't as much of a clock per se because you had to keep resetting it. Still, it was incredibly useful to sailors especially, who could use it on boats without it being affected by what direction they were going. Or the rise and the fall of the ocean waves, it just relied on gravity. The first hourglass was supposedly invented by a French monk named Luitprand in the 8th century, but our first solid evidence of the hourglass was from the 14th century. Can you imagine not being able to keep track of time? I guess your life would be based on something very different from how we have today.
Seasonal thing. Okay, dedicated listener. This is going to be our premier obscure, awesome trivia. OAT. OAT. Whichever listener emails us first at bristolbanterpodcast @gmail.com will get mentioned on our next podcast. You have to email us your name and the correct answer.
And it all has to be family friendly.
Yes. The question for this episode is, which country had the first stock exchange established in 1460 AD? The first stock exchange. So investments that you buy and sell, not just with that company, but as an exchange.
We're looking for the name of the country.
Yes. 1460.
So let us know at bristolbanterpodcast@gmail.com. Give us your name or whatever name you want to give. And if there's something you want to plug, we will consider plugging it. And the first one who writes us with the correct answer will get mentioned on the next show.
Well, that's it for our first episode. You can find us on the Geek Dad Podcast Network through iTunes and Stitcher. You can reach us directly at bristolbanterpodcast@gmail.com. As always, we strive to ensure all of our information is accurate, but we are human, so if we mess up, let us know. If you correct something we said, we will mention you in the next podcast with the correct information. Tune in next time.
Bye.
This podcast has been a production of the Geek Dad Podcast Network. If you've enjoyed this content, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geekdad.